From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
There is a temptation to think when someone emerges from the deepest, darkest dungeon that somehow that makes it right, that all is well. It doesn't make it right. It's simply living evidence of an appalling chasm, not just for that person to have fallen into, but for the whole of our society morally to have fallen into.
Today, a rare interview with one of the leading human rights advocates in Britain, Gareth Pearce. She's the attorney for two of the four British citizens just released from Guantanamo Bay to Britain. This as a U.S. federal court rules the Guantanamo tribunals unconstitutional, and the Senate debates the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez. Then, the Fifth World Social Forum wraps up in Porto Alegre. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, initial results from Sunday's election are expected to be released as early as today, but final results won't be known for at least another week. Militant leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has vowed to continue fighting despite Sunday's election. He described the election as, quote, an American game. In other news from Iraq, a video was broadcast Monday that purported to show Iraqi fighters shooting down a British military plane, killing between 10 and 15 people on board. While questions were raised about the authenticity about the video, it's now widely believed the plane was shot down. Questions have emerged in the British press over whether the plane was part of a secret special operations effort. It was flying to a site north of Baghdad where there are ordinarily no British soldiers. In the northern city of Kirkuk, it appears the main Kurdish alliance will win two-thirds of the vote in a regional election to form the provincial council. This raises new fears that tension could escalate between the Kurds and Turkey. Turkey opposes the oil-rich city of Kirkuk from being the capital of the autonomous Kurdish region. Because of the area's oil wealth, Turkey also fears the Kurdish area may break away from the rest of Iraq and form a separate country. In other news from Iraq, four Iraqi prisoners have been shot dead by U.S. guards inside a jail in the southern part of the country. The U.S. military said the killings came during a 45-minute prison riot. Six other prisoners were injured. Three U.S. Marines were also killed in Iraq on Monday. In news from Washington, under pressure from Congress, the Pentagon has announced plans to increase death payments by nearly $250,000 to families of U.S. troops killed in combat zones. The proposed rise would be applied retroactively for all troops killed in Iraq and Afghanistan since October 2001. A federal judge ruled Monday detainees held at Guantanamo Bay have a right to challenge their detention in court and that the military tribunal set up by the Pentagon violated both the Constitution and the Geneva Conventions. The judge, Joyce Hens Green of Federal District Court in Washington, also rejected Bush administration's request to throw out lawsuits filed by 54 detainees protesting their imprisonment. The judge wrote the war on terror, quote, cannot negate the existence of the most basic fundamental rights for which the people of this country have fought and died for well over 200 years. The decision, however, contradicts another recent federal court ruling, increasing the likelihood that a higher court, possibly the Supreme Court, will take up the issue. A new UN report on Sudan has criticized the government and its militia of systematically abusing and killing civilians in the Darfur region. But the report falls short of accusing the Sudanese government of committing genocide. The commission did conclude that some individuals carried out, quotes, acts with genocidal intent. Over the last 2 years, at least 70,000 people have been killed. More than 2 million have been forced to become refugees. The United Nations investigators called for the perpetrators to be tried by the International Criminal Court in The Hague, but the Bush administration, which opposes the court, wants the UN to set up a separate tribunal to hear the case. Chief UN Nuclear Inspector Mohammed al-Bardi has criticized the Bush administration for discussing the possibility of attacking Iran. Al-Bardi said such talk is, quote, very unhelpful, and he encouraged the U.S. to try to engage Iran in a dialogue over its nuclear program. 2 weeks ago, Vice President Dick Cheney acknowledged that the U.S. or Israel may attack Iran. In addition, recent news reports indicate the U.S. already has secret commandos inside the country and that the Air Force has begun flying over Iranian airspace. El-Bardi said, quote, talk about military activities at this stage is very unhelpful. I cannot see how a military solution can resolve the Iran issue, he said. In news from Nepal, the country's king has dissolved the entire government and declared a state of emergency, suspending all fundamental rights of citizens. The king claimed the move was needed to, quote, restore democracy and law and order. Political leaders accused the king of carrying out a coup. Nepal's ousted prime minister said, quote, it's an anti-democratic step and we strongly denounce this act. The step has thrown the country into a grave crisis, he said. A new survey of high school students has found one in three feel that newspapers should get government approval of stories prior to publication. One-third of students also said the press has, quote, too much freedom. Jack Dvorak, director of the High School Journalism Institute at Indiana University in Bloomington, said the survey confirms students are not learning enough about the First Amendment in school. The NAACP announced Monday it's refusing to cooperate with the Internal Revenue Service as the agency investigates whether the nation's oldest civil rights organization violated its tax-exempt status by criticizing President Bush. The IRS announced its probe weeks before November's presidential election. NAACP's interim president, Dennis Hayes, said the probe, quote, was clearly motivated by partisan politics and intended to divert us from impartial voter registration, unquote. The IRS launched the investigation after NAACP chair Julian Bond gave a speech criticizing President Bush's war, economic, and educational policies. The IRS claims Bond may have violated federal regulations that bar certain tax-exempt organizations from engaging in political activity. University of Colorado at Boulder Professor Ward Churchill has resigned his post as head of the school's Ethnic Studies Department after an uproar over an article he wrote just after the September 11th attacks. He will remain a professor at the school. Churchill's a longtime Native rights activist and leader of the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement. Churchill's article recalled how U.S. foreign policies in Iraq and its support of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians played a role in the attack inspiring the hijackers. In addition, Churchill questioned whether the victims inside the World Trade Center should be described as, quote, innocent civilians. Churchill wrote, quote, they were civilians of a sort, but innocent? Give me a break. They formed a technocratic core at the very heart of America's global financial empire, the mighty engine of profit, unquote. Churchill accused the victims of September 11th as being too busy in their own lives to see the abuses being carried out by the U.S. overseas. This week, Churchill said, quote, the overriding question that was being posed at the time was, why did this happen? Why did they hate us so much? And my premise was, when you do this to other people's families and children, that is going to be a natural response, unquote. The essay received little attention until he was invited to speak at Hamilton College in New York. His speech is still scheduled to take place on Thursday, but it has generated a firestorm of protest. New York Governor George Pataki criticized the school for inviting Churchill. He said, quote, there's a difference between freedom of speech and inviting a bigoted terrorist supporter, unquote. And in an update on a story we covered a month ago, Iraqi war veteran Harold Noel has found a home. When we spoke to him in December, he and his family were homeless, even though he just returned from fighting in Iraq. On Wednesday, he moved into a new apartment in the Bronx. An anonymous donor donated a full year of rent and enough money for furnishings. While moving in, he told reporters, quote, my fight might be over, but it's not over for all the veterans who are still in my situation. I won't stop fighting for everyone who ends up like me.
America, how are you? I'm just just calling to check in. 'Cause lately you've not been yourself. I think you've forgotten something. You've forgotten yourself. Forgotten who you are. You've become the mean night bully, standing up behind the bar, shoving dollars in your pockets with bootleggers in the back. You got the cops out in the front room.
Erica Luckett, America, How Are You? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge ruled Monday the military tribunal set up by the Pentagon to determine the status of men and women held at Guantanamo Bay are unconstitutional in nature since they don't allow detainee access to lawyers or to evidence against them. The ruling explicitly shoots down the legal theory pushed by Alberto Gonzalez that the prisoners are, as a default, not protected by the Geneva Conventions. The Senate today debates the confirmation of Gonzalez to be Attorney General. In the ruling, the judge wrote that the war on terror cannot, quote, negate the existence of the most fundamental rights for which the people of this country have fought and died for well over 200 years. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said, quote, we respectfully disagree with the decision. He went on to point to a contradictory ruling last week that found Guantanamo detainees had no legal way to challenge their detention. The case will likely end up in the Supreme Court. Monday's ruling comes a week after four British citizens were released without charge from Guantanamo after nearly 3 years in prison. They were held for 24 hours by British authorities before being released to their families. They're now suing the U.S. government for tens of millions of dollars in damages. The four, Mohsen Beg, Feroz Abbasi, Martin Mubanga, and Richard Belmar. On Democracy Now!, we've covered these cases extensively, particularly that of Mohsen Beg. Detained in Pakistan in 2001, imprisoned without charge or trial in Guantanamo after being transferred there from a base in Afghanistan, for nearly 2 years he had no contact with fellow prisoners, denied access to daylight, kept in seclusion. Following his release, Beg wrote in a letter to the London Observer, quote, I'm still attempting to fully comprehend the sheer magnitude of this whole episode and its profound effect on my life. He goes on to write, quote, it's imperative I remain in seclusion with my family and begin to readjust to my new reality, one that permits more than three paces in any direction without cages or constraints. Gareth Pierce is the attorney for Mohsen Beg, as well as Richard Belmar. Pierce is one of the leading human rights lawyers in Britain. She represented the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, as well as the three other British citizens released from Guantanamo last year, known as the Tipton Three. Actress Emma Thompson played Gareth Pierce's character in the movie In the Name of the Father. This past weekend, I was in Britain and Ireland as part of our international Exception to the Ruler's book and media tour. And we had the chance of a rare interview with Gareth Pierce, sitting down in her home for an extended period of time. I began by asking her about the release of Mohsen Beg.
The experience of the four detainees coming back was a very contrived affair done for public consumption, not just of this country, but for America as well, and was totally bogus. And at no point, I'm completely sure, was there ever an intention properly to interrogate the detainees, and there was no conclusion ever likely to happen other than that they would be released very quickly. So it was an extravaganza for the purposes of press and publicity with no proper investigative purpose whatsoever.
And what was it like when Mohsen came home, one of the four detainees, and saw his family?
I knew Mohsen Beg from years before. He was a passionate campaigner on behalf of other people wrongly imprisoned. I had in my mind's eye how he was, and I was shocked when I saw him again in the police station. He was in the shape of someone who is against all the odds, retained his mental agility and his depth of serious thought, but at what cost? One could see some of that. He had lost enormous amounts of weight, a man who didn't have enormous amounts of weight to lose, and one sees the strain, one sees the effect.
And what has been the effect on his family? He has a wife and...
He has a wife and four children. He hadn't met his youngest child. His youngest son was born after he was unlawfully seized in Pakistan. I think when people emerge from wrongful conviction or from having been taken hostage, then the reacquaintanceship between family members is far more difficult than is anticipated. All of the hostages who've returned from the Lebanon, all of the men and women in this country wrongly imprisoned say the same thing, that for years all you have thought is that if you got out, or if your husband got out, or your son, everything would be fine. And of course, in many ways it is, but your own psychic space within society has been filled, and you're coming back and you're not just re-entering a life that's had to go on without you, you're reacquainting yourself with people, however well you know them, who have been forced to change because of what has happened to you. And so if you're Moisen Beg, you left a father who was an invalid, who you were worried about, and only in captivity you learned that he had in fact had a successful operation. But when you come back, you find a father who's been campaigning for 3 years solidly and who's become a well-known national figure, and you left yourself in anonymity, and you've come back and you're known and your name is known, and you're not just someone the press wants to speak to, you're someone other aspects of the press want to vilify. There is one scandalous tabloid newspaper here that has effectively put a bounty on the heads of those who've returned, who said, if you know the whereabouts of these men, ring the Sun newspaper this number. They're unable to re-enter the life they left in the same way. They're not the same people, and they can't pick up where they left off. Sorry, that's much too long for your purposes.
No, that's fine. We're not soundbite radio. We really appreciate a full explanation like this. What was Moisen Beg charged with?
Oh, he's not charged with anything. He was tortured and brutalized in wholly unlawful conditions for 3 years. He was living with his family, not clandestinely, in Pakistan. He was unlawfully captured by Americans with British complicity, with Pakistani complicity, and taken to Bagram in Afghanistan, where he was held for a year, as he said in the one letter that came out from there, without having seen the sun or the moon or the stars for an entire year, and brutalized and degraded and humiliated, and then taken to Guantanamo, where he was the only person we know of, well, maybe others we don't know of, but the only person we know of who was in complete isolation for 2 years, and that may be because he witnessed the murder of two detainees in Bagram Air Base, and perhaps to keep that deep, dark secret for as long as possible, he was not kept with the others. He was kept in Guantanamo without any natural light, in a tiny cell area where even exercise was without access to any other detainees. It's astounding to me that he has retained his intellect and his ability to articulate as extraordinarily as he has. He, one has to say, is a person with enormous reserves of strength and spiritual resources.
Mm-hmm. What exactly did he see at Bagram? How were these two men killed?
I've no idea of the details yet. He's written to me in two letters which eventually came out. He's referred to it in passing. I haven't been interrogating him at some time in the future, when and if he has the wish to talk more, then that, I'm sure, will be of great importance to learn. But he's come back to a family which needs him and which he needs to reacquaint, and I respect him for getting his priorities straight and saying, at some point I will do my duty to explain what has gone on. That point may come quickly, but I need to be with my family now.
Has he and the other three men who've just been released from Guantanamo to here in Britain sued the U.S. government?
The American lawyers he had lodged a simultaneous claim for habeas corpus and an action brought under the Alien Torts Act in America. As I understand it, the U.S. government is attempting or has attempted to strike out that action on the basis that he is now no longer under American control. And I know nothing of the possible future of that action. What I do know is if there is justice, these men ought to receive reparation. What has happened to them has been in breach of every basic international minimum norm and guarantee, and they have been tortured. There is no getting around it. They have been subjected to criminal behavior.
Gareth Pearce, leading British human rights advocate, attorney for two of the four British men who returned from Guantanamo, were released to Britain last week. We'll continue with our discussion in a minute.
Like the sermon on the mountain, says the Dharma got dumb. Hellfire and brimstone, swap for oil and guns. When we're pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of Father, maybe, but not in my name. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground.
Jacob's Ladder, Chumbawamba here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue our rare interview with the leading British human rights attorney, Gareth Pearce. She's a lawyer for Mozambique and Richard Belmar, two of the four British citizens released from Guantanamo Bay last week after nearly 3 years in detention without charge.
The other detainee I represent is Richard Belmar, who's recently returned.
What about his case? What was he? Where was he picked up? How was he captured? And who is his family?
His family are living in London. He did not have lawyers until very recently, and in consequence, we know far less about him. And there's been an enormous sustained campaign in this country about Mozambique and others, and the name Richard Belmar was not known in the same way, although his sister has been bravely trying to make the fact of his disappearance known. He's a much younger man. He's someone who, upon re-entry, we see as perhaps being quite damaged, needing real help of a kind that is not made available here at all. One minute they're in Paddington Green police station, the next minute they're out on the street with a pack of press, for better or for worse, wanting to talk to them. Nowhere to live other than their families' houses, which are known about by the press, and the immediate priority with each family was to get the detained person away from the police station into an anonymous location where they could at least talk to their families. The whole of the past few days have been devoted to that and nothing else.
How was Mozambique captured? How was he taken or arrested?
Because he was living with his wife and children and was seized from the house they were living in, we've known about his capture from the first moment. He was taken by men who he describes as thugs, Pakistani and American, taken in a car. We had always thought that he had managed to ring his father from a mobile phone somewhere in the back of a car, but he explained to me 2 days ago, in fact, he was seized, he was placed in a cell, and he found in his pocket then his mobile phone. And his father received a telephone call from him within hours of his capture saying, "I don't know who's taken me. There are American voices. I don't know what's going to happen." And no more was heard until the Red Cross telephoned his father from Bagram in Afghanistan, saying, "We have a Mozambique here." But we brought, on his behalf, legal action in Pakistan, habeas corpus, to say, "Where is he? Deliver him to the court." And every relevant ministry put in an affidavit to say, "We have not taken him. We do not have him." And yet, there he is in American hands within 10 days. It's kidnapping. Utterly unlawful.
While the government hasn't charged him, they said that he was training at al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan. Is that what they have said?
It's what the Pentagon is pumping out as information, no doubt, to attempt to discredit Mozambique. That is not true. He says unequivocally, "It's not true. I believe totally what he says. He is the most scrupulously honest, careful person." And at some stage, if anyone has the wit to want to understand what he will say, then there will be a chilling history of American brutality and mendacity, and there will be a complete exoneration of Muizenberg.
Is he explaining now why he visited Afghanistan?
We've known. We've always known. He emigrated to Afghanistan with his wife and children, tragically for him, in the summer of 2001, in order to live in the only probable experiment that at that time was existing in the world, an experiment in an Islamic society. And he went in order to set up a school with his wife, and the plan was that they would both teach. And there they were in Kabul. They had bought a house, they were living there, they were establishing themselves, and then the invasion happened and they had to get out. And they got out to Pakistan, re-established themselves, again started up life in the house in which they were living, and it was at that point he was seized. And so everything that was ever said by President Bush or Prime Minister Blair about these are bad men captured on the battlefield was utterly untrue, completely, utterly untrue.
Is the Pentagon saying he earlier had spent time in Afghanistan at another trip by himself?
You'll have to ask the Pentagon what they're saying. I don't know. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. What is Mozum saying happened to him in Guantanamo? How was he tortured?
Well, so far, he's spoken to an American lawyer who saw him there, who has signed a gagging order. And what Mozum says, at some point, he will say properly. What we know from every other detainee who's emerged from Guantanamo is that the methodology that was used was consistent and involved interrogation in extreme conditions with coercive methods that included sleep deprivation, bullying, threatening. But I've also had from Muizenberg an extended statement in which he's described how under threat of death he was forced to make a false confession, and that he witnessed the murder of two detainees in Bagram, and that he has consistently complained about the treatment he's been accorded. That much we know. I am sure there is much more to come.
You say he was immediately released, pretty much, from British detention after being flown in from Guantanamo.
Yeah.
But then what happened? Is he free?
Yes.
Was there any move by the British government to do anything to go after him and the other men who have been released?
No.
Did you say that they said that they're introducing a new law?
For a year. Tony Blair has said, because the government here has been consistently criticised for its failure to do anything to achieve the return of the remaining four British detainees, Tony Blair has repeatedly said it would be reasonable for the Americans to expect us to have structures in place that would ensure the safety and security of our countries. That's what he said. Is it a coincidence that on the day they return, the Home Secretary announces new measures? The answer may be yes and no. No, because we had, in a separate situation, achieved an enormous victory when they had introduced internment in this country, attempted to in a cheap imitation of the Patriot Act, both disgraceful legislative measures. We had achieved a victory after 3 years of struggle for the men detained here. The House of Lords said, this is utterly unlawful. You can't lock people up indefinitely without trial here. However, it is extremely suspicious that on the day that the government reacts to that House of Lords ruling, happens to be the day when the Guantanamo detainees come back. Is this yet another pathetic attempt by the government of this country to please the Americans, to ape the Americans in their unlawful legislative program. Maybe. Maybe it's just bluff and bluster. Maybe it's just saber-rattling. Probably is. There is no legislation in place. The legislation that has been flagged up in relation to monitoring or detaining British citizens who it's unable to charge, I don't think that'll pass muster in Parliament. It also is unlawful. The proposals are unlawful. The fact is, the police delivered him to the address his family was waiting at. They left him and said, basically, you're on your own now. He's no threat to anyone. He's a law-abiding, peaceful, thoughtful person who has a future doing a great deal of good in the world.
Gareth Pearce is one of the leading human rights lawyers in Britain. I was speaking to her in her home in London this weekend. The lawyer for both Mozambique and Richard Belmar, two of the four British detainees who were released to Britain from Guantanamo last week. They are now with their families. As we continue with our interview, I went on to ask her to compare the detentions at Guantanamo with anything else she has worked on in her life. This is Gareth Pearce.
Of course, we have not seen anything like this before, as absolutely breathtaking, audacious, unlawful kidnapping of vast numbers of people, simply not caring that it is tantamount to shredding up every international treaty obligation which all our countries have subscribed to. What I see it as is an experiment by America to see what interrogative methodology it could use and obtain results in disregard completely of the fact that this, well, consciously, in fact, knowing that it was using prohibited methods, an experiment to see what you could get, disregarding the fact that experience tells us it must be nonsense what you get from coercive interrogation, but also an experiment in testing reaction internationally and nationally. Will there be protest? Have we gone too far? And tragically, the answer probably is the experiment's successful. There has not been world revulsion expressed that has compelled the United States to back down, to apologize, to release everyone, to pay reparation, to achieve a mea culpa and an acknowledgement this should never be done again. No. Rumsfeld has said the recent results of the American election endorse our methods. There is a shameless intention to continue, maybe falter for a moment, maybe there's been criticism, but not enough to stop it. And the result of the experiment is that worldwide there has now been a message: you can abandon every treaty obligation, abandon Geneva Conventions, abandon human rights law, abandon guarantees of prohibition on torture. You can do the lot, and if you're strong enough and powerful enough and saber rattle war on terror terminology, nobody's going to stop you. That's the tragic outcome.
Would you say that the British citizens were released because of pressure from Tony Blair as a partner of George Bush? And do you see this as a model for what will happen to the other prisoners? There are still hundreds being held. What distinguishes these men who've been released?
It wasn't Tony Blair who did a single thing to help. I think it was the reverse, that it wasn't accidental that two British citizens were amongst the first six nominees for military commissions. In my view, that was a miscalculation by both our governments, and it was intended as a present to our government by the American administration. Okay, you want to say you've got a threat in your country. Here's proof positive. However, unexpectedly for the government, the British public across the board, every aspect of political thinking, the thought that British nationals were detained in horrific cages and humiliated and tortured and facing, as was said at that time, the death sentence, caused a revulsion. It was not to be, and our government was forced to start doing something. It did too little, too late. It did it ineffectively. It traded bodies, and who knows what else has been given or taken as gifts politically because of this. But these four came back because of public pressure, not because of any political morality whatsoever on the part of our government. And there are still many long-term British residents in Guantanamo for whom our government has surrogate responsibility, including refugees, about whom they're doing nothing. They do nothing, and they have to be compelled to do something.
In terms of the latest British torture scandal, similar to the soldiers who are now being charged and on trial who tortured people at Abu Ghraib. Yeah. Can you comment on that? I don't think a lot of people in the United States have even heard about pictures showing British soldiers torturing prisoners in Iraq and where that happened.
Right. Well, there's nothing like the power of the photograph. And one imagines if there's one military reaction for the future to this, it is prohibit cameras rather than prohibit tactics. That's a tragic reality. But our hypocrisy is considerable. Our Home Office has acknowledged in the appalling internment procedures we introduced here, which have now been declared illegal, our Home Office acknowledged that we use, for the purposes of intelligence here, information obtained from torture, and we are prepared to use it. Our only caveat is what weight we give it. And our courts have endorsed that up to date. There's still an appeal to the House of Lords on this point. At the moment, the shameful state of law in this country is that it's okay to use torture. It's simply not okay if it was British agents carrying it out. Now, that again is Guantanamo writ large. Okay if someone else does it. We needn't be too choosy, but we will use it. And again, that is a recipe for the destruction of all guaranteed international minimum norms.
Leading British human rights advocate Gareth Pearce, the attorney for two of the four British men released from Guantanamo, having been held there for almost 3 years, released without charge. They are now in Britain with their families. We broadcast this program today on the day the full Senate begins the debate on the confirmation of White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General of the United States. Many say it was Alberto Gonzalez who laid the legal groundwork for the torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo by saying that the Geneva Conventions do not apply. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Tão longe, a alegria estava então. Tão longe, o seu sorriso de verão. Eu sei quanto custou ter que esperar. Até seu precioso bom humor voltar. Simplesmente um grande balão. Voar
Gilberto Gil, Il Povo. He performed at the World Social Forum this week, now serves as Brazil's cultural minister under Lula, who also attended the World Social Forum, along with the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The fifth World Social Forum ended Monday in the southern city of Porto Alegre. Over 120,000 participants attended 6 days of conferences, discussions, and a vast spectrum of issues from environmental conservation to global poverty to the war in Iraq. Today we'll play one of the speeches at this global gathering, George Martin from the United for Peace and Justice here in the United States spoke. He was on a panel made up of voices from the United States addressing the World Social Forum on the war in Iraq.
The Bush regime has transgressed international law. The United Nations, the Geneva Convention, our own U.S. Constitution, our own U.S. civil liberties, and the immigrant rights of people who've come to America. This administration has transgressed the lives of millions of people around the world and is responsible for the deaths of more than 100,000 Afghani and Iraqi people. We say no to the Bush regime. We are United for Peace and Justice. We come from all over the United state, every county, small towns, large towns. We come from national organizations, seven national coalitions. We are composed of more than 1,000 organizations across the United States. August 29th, we brought more than 500,000 people to the Republican National Convention for the largest political demonstration in U.S. history. Like many of you, we are upset and disheartened by this last election, especially with a long year of working hard on the electoral basis for many of our NGOs. At the same time, during that election, we faced two candidates who were trying to out-militarize each other. And we prepared for whomever won to continue our agenda. Sad to say, Bush was illicitly selected again, and for many reasons, and that's been debated and talked about a lot. We look forward to continuing our work. We look forward to a quick 4 years. On the immediate horizon, you know, our tools are education, they're lobbying, they're public witness and demonstration. As bad as this last election was, the election polls indicated that more than one half of the American public was against the reasons why we went to war. But at the same time, they were not ready to take the position to say, bring our troops home. That is now our mission, to educate and to move many of those exit pollers to the center, far away from the right, to the left, so that we can change things about war. From now until March, our organizations across the United States will be conducting town hall meetings for an open public discussion on the war of Iraq, encouraging people who are not with us, who have questions, encouraging our families, our friends, our neighbors, our co-workers to come to these meetings around the country and discuss the issue of the war on Iraq. We need to educate the American public. Our greatest barrier is the media, and there's a whole lot going on there, but this is our approach going right to the grassroots. On the legislative end, Bush's supplementary appropriations for war in Afghanistan and Iraq are coming up very shortly. It's our job to fight to reduce those budgets, to delete some of those budgets, and that's where we'll be, pressuring our congresspeople across the country, lobbying to decrease this budget and to decrease this war. About a month ago, we had a victory in that Congress reduced the budget for research on handheld nuclear weapons and bunker busters. We gained ground from last year's budget in terms of those reductions. Things can happen. It's a bleak future, but these are the things that we have to work with for now and for the future. Regarding public witness demonstration, it's been mentioned that the second anniversary of the attack on Iraq is coming up. And we're poised with a national call to action for a major event, probably in either Washington or New York. But during these last 2 years, in order to build the movement, we have encouraged local actions. We expect more than 350 local actions across the United States in addition to the major mobilization. And that's the approach that we're taking to grow this movement, to do things locally and regionally and educate and bring people in the fold, to train them, to create new constituencies, to lobby our Congress, and to change things that happen. You know, when our Congress took the vote for preemptive attack on Iraq, we polled their offices the day before. All our congressional representatives and senators. The telephone calls, the faxes, the letters, and the emails were 10 to 1 against war. 10 to 1. And the vast majority of Congress went along with Bush and voted for war. Who do they represent? Vested interests, multinational interests, not the American people. As they passed that vote for war, they tacked on an addendum to say that American consumers could not sue pharmaceutical companies. Our Congress doesn't represent the people. And we're going to work hard during these next 2 years as their election comes up in 2 years to put the pressure on them. And if they don't vote the way we want them to vote, we are going to work doubly hard to replace them and change the nature of the American Congress and move it more toward the left and the progressive end so that we do not have these foreign policies that disrupt the whole world. You know, as we talk about the anniversary of the attack on Iraq, I want to talk about my visit a bit. I went about a year ago with a delegation from United for Peace and Justice. And it was our second delegation. We had sent a delegation of military families and veterans for peace over in December and decided to send a second delegation on a fact-finding mission to really see what the occupation was all about and to hear from the Iraqi people how they felt about occupation and how they felt about their future. I'll tell you, things were so much worse than what I expected. And they are so, so much worse right now. I want to talk about a couple of aspects that we don't hear often. And I want to talk about the children of Iraq. And I want to talk about our U.S. troops also. You know, as we see the television screen, we see men fighting in violence. More than half the people in Iraq are children under 14 years of age. Children under 14 years of age. More than half the people of Iraq are women. Innocent people not involved in the previous politics and what's going on today. And suffering so much. Suffering through 10 years of the Iraq sanctions. And continued suffering. When I visited, way less than half the children were going to school. And from our friends who are returning, and our friends are returning because they jeopardize our other friends in Iraq and Iraqi people by just being there. And most recently, we had friends return from AFSC. And things have not gotten any better. I see time is running short here, and I get to going, and I could go a lot. But women and children suffer on a daily basis. I visited the Performing Arts Center, a cultural building that was not supposed to have been bombed. Remember our Spark bombs? It blew the roof off the building. There were 500 homeless women and kids squatting in that building. There are more than 500,000 homeless women and kids living in Baghdad and suffering every day. We need to end this war. For the sake of time, I'm going to pass on our troops, and I want to share a very important story with you. I met a woman named Vivian Saleem. She had 4 kids. And as we remember the attack on Baghdad, shock and awe, to us on television, it looked like the 4th of July. We had that old literal feeling about the cleansing night. We don't see the destruction. We don't see the violence. We understand the death and injury, but we don't talk about the psychological violence. There are hundreds of thousands of kids in Iraq who cannot sleep alone at night based upon being exposed to that massive noise and destruction. They hear a glass break or a bullet, they piss on themselves. And only 70 psychologists in the whole country, and they're getting 10% of what they ask for under reconstruction to work with the youngest kids. I met this woman named Vivian. During shock and awe, the thunder, the noise rained down so hard, her kids were going out of their mind. And her husband packed up their 4 kids in the car and a couple things and were trying to get out of town. And they ran across one of our U.S. tanks coming forward toward them. And her husband stood up in the doorway and was talking to the tank driver. Her husband, an Iraqi, was an engineer trained at the University of Virginia in the United States. Truly, we have a global society. And as he was talking to the driver, trying to explain to him that his kids were freaking out there, just trying to get out of town, another tank came from the right and blew up the car. Vivian lost her husband and her 4 kids that day. And all she could say was, why? I want somebody responsible to tell me why this should happen. No parent should have to go through this. I heard the same thing from my friend, Lila Lipscomb of Fahrenheit 9/11, whose son was in the army and he died in Iraq. The same thing in terms of no parent should go through this. I heard that from my friend Rita Lazar of 9/11 Families from Peaceful Tomorrows, who lost loved ones in the towers and at the Pentagon, that no family should have to go through this. United for peace and justice, we are. We say no to the Bush regime. We say no to war, to hate, to lies, and to greed. We say, in this occupation, bring our troops home now.
George Martin of United for Peace and Justice speaking at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil. It wrapped up yesterday. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359 or go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, as well as Jeremy Scahill and John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Again, happy birthday to Anna Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.